1968, Thornburg against Gingles. Mr. Attorney General.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Honorable Court, this case in its final posture before the Court involves four multi-member House legislative districts and one multi-member Senate district in the state of North Carolina. Two other districts, House District 8 and Senate District 2, are no longer part of this appeal. The primary challenge to the lower court's judgment by the original defendants is based on that court's interpretation of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act as amended in 1982. The panel court found infirmities in each of the districts that was challenged and ultimately fashioned a remedy requiring the use of majority black legislative single-member districts where they could be drawn, and in each of the multi-member districts as they were constituted originally, they largely followed county lines and consisted of whole counties. From this decision, the defendants sought review, and the Solicitor General joined in that request. We ask this Honorable Court to apply Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act so as to afford due respect to the intentions of the Congress without endorsing the undue expansion of these intentions by the lower courts. We would encourage a decision that would enunciate definitive yet fair and realistic standards for evaluating the election practices in all jurisdictions. And we do this to the end that this Honorable Court's determinations might acknowledge the right of those jurisdictions to determine their own electoral affairs so long as they neither intentionally or unintentionally deny to any minority group the emphatic opportunity to participate fully and equally in the electoral process. We do so to the additional end that your ruling might foster political unity as opposed to disunity among the electorate. The panel court suggested that it was paying adherence to the proposition that no protected class of persons has a constitutional right or statutory right to proportional representation or to guaranteed political success. But pursuant to Section 2, the court found that it had been shown by the plaintiffs that North Carolina's political process were not open equally to participation by the racial minorities. And this was purportedly based on use of certain factors that were denoted by the Senate in the legislative history of the Section 2 amendments. These factors are certainly well known to the court and should have been imported to the district court, not as a mechanical checklist of conclusive indicators, but rather a set of guidelines for determining whether the characteristics of the jurisdictions being examined parallel those of jurisdictions examined in the cases to which the Senate referred, particularly White versus Register, Whitcomb versus Chaffetz, and Zimmer versus McKeithen. And we submit that had the district court applied these factors in the manner intended, giving primary weight all the while to the words of the statute, and properly analyzing the cases from which these factors came, then North Carolina would have prevailed in that court. I think, Your Honor, that they sought to apply them more as a checklist rather than as an indicator of what actually had occurred, which leads me to call the court's attention.
Yes, they did purport to apply them.
Oh, I think they purported to apply them, but didn't undertake the
proper. You disagree with the way they apply
certainly
them.
Do. And we say, if Your Honor please, that the counties and the districts that are involved in this case certainly in no way can be equated to the counties of Bexar County and Dallas County, which are the two counties in Texas that were involved in the White decision. Durham County, North Carolina, for example, with a 28.6% black registration, has had proportional representation in the North Carolina House since 1973. Two of the five county commissioners are black. Two of the four district court judges are black, all of whom ran at large. The chairman of the Democratic Party from 69 to 79 and from 83 to present was black, and one of the three members of the Board of Elections from 1970 to 1981 was black when a member resigned and went on the North Carolina State Board of Elections. Wake County, with a 15.1% black registration, has a representative serving his second term. The sheriff of Wake County, elected by the at-large electorate, is black, one of seven county commissioners, two of eight district court judges, a black senator from 75 through 78, and from 77 to the present, a member of the Board of Elections.
General Thornburg, is it your position that the court below was required to focus on the individual election districts rather than the state as a whole?
Yes, Your Honor. We contend that a lot of the use of the statistics that appear in this record involve statewide statistics as opposed to statistics in these particular districts.
Do
which
our
we're coming
precedents,
here to defend.
Do the cases from this court indicate that that is a requirement?
As we read
Section
them and understand
2,
them, Your Honor, that this
that you
court,
look at the individual
I
districts.
Believe you say use the words intensely local appraisal. And we contend that the court did not do that in this case as regards these districts. And, for example, in Wake County, where you have an at-large electorate electing the sheriff, he went into his second term with 63.5%.
Well, do we have to apply a clearly erroneous standard to the review of the factors found by the court below?
Your Honor, we do not feel that the clearly erroneous, the Rule 52 standard, should be applied in this case to prescribe your reviewing the facts in the case. We contend that what is before the court is a mixed question of law and fact, and that in order to appropriately determine the case, you have to apply, you have to look at the facts as found and apply them, the law, appropriately to those facts.
Well, specifically, what are the legal errors that you believe were made below?
We simply say that the court failed to apply the wording of the statute, and rather than taking the statute which deals with access and opportunity to participate in the electoral process as clear wording, it simply found the various factors without making a causal connection and applied those and simply did not apply the law and fashioned a remedy which is specifically prescribed by the statute where it says that nothing in this should be interpreted, nothing in the section should be interpreted to establish a right to have members of a protected class elected in numbers equal to their proportion in the population. And this is precisely what the district court did by way of fashioning a remedy in this case. We contend, Your Honor, please, that
I suppose you can do things as a remedy for constitutional rights that you just couldn't do in the absence of a remedy, in the absence of a violation.
Sure.
And you really fundamentally disagree with the finding of a violation.
Yes, we do. We say that if you take this, you take the statute and apply it to these facts, if Your Honor please, that you come out with a different result.
There's no violation of the statute.
That's correct, Your Honor.
I meant.
That is our contention. And we contend that by applying the law as the court did and by fashioning the remedy in the manner in which it did, that it expanded the scope far beyond the intent of Congress in the passing of this act. These facts, as found by the court, will demonstrate that blacks in these challenged districts have run for office, are always competitive, and often win. In fact, no elected black incumbent member of the General Assembly who has offered for re-election has ever been defeated. Blacks receive Democratic Party support for their candidacy. They hold positions of power and leadership within the party structure, and they have equal access to the process under the at-large schemes and had achieved proportional representation at the time of this trial in each of the districts with the exception of Mecklenburg County. And we consider, of course, that voter registration, as indicated by the facts in the case, should be important to the court. In this case, from 80 to 82, statewide registration among whites decreased by 112,000, but increased by 12,000 in the black community. It's true that blacks in the challenge districts fall below whites in most of the socioeconomic indicators. But the electoral success of the blacks in these districts, in the various offices, and their membership on the Board of Elections and in party positions and so on, indicates that the socioeconomic factors are no longer an obstacle to their participation and meaningful participation in the political process. And we suggest that it defies common sense to count these factors as indicia of unequal participation when the direct evidence as exists in these districts shows to the contrary. I would call to the court's attention also that none of these counties is a Section 5 county. Only 40 of our 100 counties are so covered. The United States Attorney General required the creation of numerous single-member legislative districts in these counties, and his determinations were never contested by North Carolina in any legal proceeding and were immediately implemented when those suggestions were made.
Mr. Attorney General, I gather if you prevail, you suggest you're entitled to an outright reversal, not further proceedings below.
We would hope for an outright reversal, Your Honor, but certainly we would, whatever the court suggests.
Well, if it were to go back, for what purpose?
If it were to...
Would we have to say that there'd been an error made in the application of the law and that we should send it back now to apply it as we say it
yes,
should
Your
be
Honor.
Applied?
We would, of course, appreciate a reversal with an interpretation of the statute and how to apply it. And in these multi-member districts, of course, we would then continue with the multi-member legislative delegations as they existed. North Carolina has historically placed a tremendous amount of importance in our counties and county lines and so on since colonial times, as a matter of fact. And that was the primary basis on which these various districts were drawn, and it has no foundation in racial-tainted motivations of any kind the district court so held.
If there were an outright reversal, then the legislature would have to start all over again, would they?
They would. I believe, if Your Honor please, maybe my colleagues to my left can verify this, but I think the General Assembly in the last session passed a statute which said that if the case is reversed, it simply goes back in these districts, these five districts that are under consideration, to the multi-member legislative district. We're a large and not a homogeneous state in the state of North Carolina, and we feel that each of these districts must be viewed individually and evaluated individually under any standard according to the particular characteristics that they exhibit.
Do you think the district court made in concluding that there was a violation of the statute?
We think the district court simply ignored the facts in the case.
Well, I know, but what's the principal way it did that?
By ignoring access to the political process, which we contend exists and the facts show. It's just a fundamental error, Your Honor. When you look at the facts and apply the law as written by Congress, you just don't have the facts to support the decision that the district court made.
May I just inquire? I also have a little trouble, as Justice White seems to be getting the heart of your theory. With respect to each of the districts, the district court did make some factual determinations. I take it you don't challenge any of those. You just say they're not sufficient to justify the end result.
Yes, Your Honor.
They went through district by district and talked about polarized voting and one thing and another. That part you accept.
That sort of thing. But we say if you apply all of that, given all of that, and take those facts as found by the court, which the facts that the court found are based on the record, but when you apply the law to those facts, then you don't come out with the result that the district court did.
Is that because your basic point, as I understand, is if the net result of all the voting is something that roughly equals proportional representation, then as a matter of law there can't be a violation of the statute?
No, Your Honor. That's not what I intended to say. That is just one of the indications. We say that you have to look, as the Congress did in lifting the White versus Register language, you have to look at the totality of the circumstances and make a final decision based on all of this And all of these access points, participation points, and so on that you have where blacks are holding elective offices, where they hold offices in party machinery, where they participate in the electoral process, taking all that into consideration, do they have equal access to the electoral process, which this is what the law requires? It doesn't place any, as we read it, it doesn't place any affirmative burden on the state to do anything, particularly except to be certain that everyone, regardless of race, creed, or color, has an equal opportunity to participate.
In what?
In the electoral process, Your Honor.
Well, in the processes, it says, doesn't the statute say, and to elect?
Let me quote Senator Dole on that.
Well, let's just quote the statute. What is it?
All right. The statute says, a violation is established if, based on the totality of the circumstances, it is shown that the political processes are not equally open to participation by members of a class of citizens protected in that its members have less opportunity than the members of the electorate to participate in the political process and to elect representatives of their choice.
And to elect.
Yes, Your Honor, and we say that that should be interpreted so as to not susceptible to the interpretation of election outcome, but means that members of a minority have a right to vote, a right to register, a right to have their vote fairly counted, and that North Carolina in these districts has been doing that.
Why do you think the cases emphasize racially polarized voting?
Certainly racially polarized voting is important in the overall decision.
Why is it?
By virtue of delusion, submergence, or whatever the effect that you choose to attach, which, of course, would occur.
But even when there's polarized voting, why, everybody's vote is counted. Nobody's denied a vote.
Nobody is denied a vote, but then if it is so submerged and subdued and diluted that it has no effect, but that is not the case here.
Well, let's just assume that the court was correct in finding that there was severe polarized voting in this case.
If you use the district court's interpretation, you could call it correct, but what the district court interpreted polarized voting as, Your Honor, was simply if more whites vote for whites and more blacks vote for blacks, then you automatically have polarized voting.
I understand your position, but if there were severe polarized voting in this case, you'd have a much tougher case, I suppose, in these multi-member
districts. If that were correct, but we do not believe it is correct, and if I may save the remainder of my time, Your Honor, for rebuttal.
And, I can ask the Solicitor General.
Mr. Solicitor General.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The formulation in the new Voting Rights Act of Section 2 was the product of intense political and, may I say, intellectual struggle. The outcome of that struggle should be quite familiar to this Court, since it simply adopted the standard, the legal standard, formulated by this Court in White v. Register. Our concern in this case is one thing only, that adjudication under this new Voting Rights Act be lawful, that it be constrained and disciplined by appellate court review, which enforces the standard that Congress enacted. Now, Congress chose a middle path between two extremes. On one hand was the extreme represented by the constitutional minimum of intentional discrimination, and that was rejected. On the other hand was the extreme of leaving the district courts at large to engineer electoral outcomes as they thought best on racial or group lines. What the Congress adapted was, if you like, an effects test. But effects on what? Effects on participation, on process, on opportunity. Now, if fidelity to that standard is to be enforced, then whatever nuances there may be in closer cases, it is our position that here, certainly in three and perhaps in all of the five contested districts, but certainly in three of them, we believe that that standard of access, of process, of opportunity has been met as a matter of law.
Mr. Freed, do you think that the court is required to make a separate vote dilution finding as to each district?
It certainly is.
Is that a legal requirement?
That is a legal requirement. This court has said so over and over again. The legislative history, the Senate report makes it quite clear that the importance is district by district.
And in doing that, did the court below effectively do that in this case, in your
view?
The
court below certainly addressed each district, but the court below also seemed to be very impressed with overall statistics in the state of North Carolina, and we think may have been misled by its attention to those overall.
It should have focused on electoral success of black candidates in each district over a period of time?
If I may, Your Honor, I would say electoral opportunity as evidenced by very great electoral success over time. Now, the reason we say that the congressional standard, the White v. Register standard, if you will, was met as a matter of law in three of those five districts is that in all of those districts, over a protracted period of time, in a couple of them over nearly a decade, black representatives equaled or exceeded the percentage of black citizens in the population. Nor was this black success achieved by contrivance or through sufferance of the majority, but, if you like, in the old-fashioned way, through politics, through participation in party politics, in some cases by black serving as chairman of the local majority political parties.
Mr. Solicitor General, the total of the racial population or the registered voters in each category?
We were addressing the harder case because we think even on the harder case, the case is made out, which is the population. If it were registration, then we could have an argument about whether that registration was in some sense unfairly depressed. But even if you take population, these factors are made out in those three districts. But the thing which we find most striking is that the single-member districts, which seem so dear to the heart of the appellees and of the district court, if those single-member, if the multi-member district had been broken up into single-member districts, the result would have been not an increase in black opportunity and participation, but a decrease, since the number of representatives, black representatives, would have been the same, yet the black citizens living outside of the favored supermajority single-member districts would have been, on the district court's hypothesis of voting patterns, deprived of an opportunity which they manifestly enjoyed under the state's previous multi-district system.
Was there any evidence in this case of barriers to registration that existed in the past?
On the contrary, Your Honor. The district court specifically found that there had been assiduous efforts to remove such barriers. Now, I would, in the last moments, simply like to say that there is some confusion suggested by appellees that we are arguing for a standard of tokenism because we speak of minorities not being locked out or shut out of the electoral process. When we do so only in quotation marks, quoting either Mr. Armin Dirfner or Senator Kennedy, when those proponents of the Act were saying, were emphasizing that the Act spoke of opportunity and access. Our language is more generous and more cautious. We say it must be equal access and equal opportunity.
Mr. Solicitor General, are you still of the view that Senator Dole's views are particularly persuasive, or have you switched now to Senator Hatch?
Not at all. We think, as we say in our brief, and I would very much direct the Court's attention to note 12 of page 8 of the brief, that it is the views of Senator Dole which ought to be given particular weight in interpreting the formulation which was arrived at. We do not, and I don't believe in our brief, do we ever attach some particular significance to the views of Senator Hatch. It's Senator Dole that we rely on, at least Senator Dole, as he spoke in the Senate. I thank the Court for its attention.
Mr. Chambers.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue presented here by the Solicitor General and by the State, I think, can be put simply, whether the election of the five black candidates in 1982 in four of the challenged electoral districts forecloses any possibility for finding that blacks in the challenged districts have been denied an equal opportunity to participate in the electoral process. I don't think that anyone would seriously argue that the facts in North Carolina prior to 1982 would warrant a finding that black votes in each of the challenged districts were substantially diluted. And so the State and the Solicitor General now contend that because five blacks were elected in these challenged districts in 1982, that should foreclose a determination that there was a violation of Section 2. The State and the Solicitor General asked the Court to ignore that in two of the districts, no black was ever elected to the State House.
Never elected to what?
To the State House of Representatives.
Yes.
House District 8 and Senate District 2. The Solicitor General and the State asked the Court to ignore all the other factors that the District Court looked at, reflecting the history of discrimination.
What time in those are both multi-member districts?
House District
8 and 2. 8 and 2.
8 is a multi-member district.
How many?
Four.
And 2?
Two is a district where the Court found the State had carved up a black residential area so that it would reduce the percentage of blacks in each district.
Is that a single-member district?
It is a single-member district.
Yes, okay.
Mr. Chambers, help me on those two districts. I understand that your opponents, they don't contest those anymore.
They now advise that they do not contest those two, but I'm talking about the initial thrust that the State and the Solicitor General presented. It included those two and also included Mecklenburg County with House District 36, among others.
Well, what about the three districts that the Solicitor General now particularly disagrees with the disagrees with the district court on?
I will talk about that right now, Your Honor.
All right.
I would first, though, like to ask the Court to look at the plaintiff's exhibits 4A through 10B as a beginning of how the district court proceeded. That's in the plaintiff's the joint appendix exhibits. Volume 2.
That's all right. We'll find them.
It begins with Plaintiff's Exhibit 4A. And that reflects House District 36.
Right.
And the other exhibits that follow talk about the other districts and have we can use this as just an example. In House District 36, we have a substantial concentration of black voters within that district who would make up or should be able to affect the results of with respect to two district representatives in that district. They would constitute more than 60% of the representatives or the electoral electorate in those districts. What the State has done, it has merged these blacks in a large, exceptionally large electoral district so that their votes are now reduced from the 60-some percent to 30-some percent, and in fact, in Mecklenburg County, less than 30 percent. In that position, they are not able to control or affect any, determine the outcome of any election.
How many How many are elected from this district?
Eight.
And how many black members were elected from District 36?
Prior to 1982, none. In 1982, one person was elected.
And no election since then?
There was an election in 1984, but that was under the plan directed by the court. While I'm on that, Your Honor, I should point out the solicitor has argued that there was a reduction as a result of the plan ordered by the court. That is not true. In fact, there was in Wake County, which I think the Solicitor General is using, in Forsyth County, House District 39, two black districts were established as a result of the plan submitted by the state. And two black representatives were elected.
I thought, Mr. Chambers, that the focus of the Solicitor General's brief was on House Districts 39, 23, and 21,
That's
rather
correct.
Than 36.
That's
Isn't
correct.
That right?
And I was, if you look at House District 23, that's reflected in the plaintiff's Exhibit 6A, that is Durham County.
Yes.
House District 39 is in Plaintiff's Exhibit 5A, and House District 21 is in Plaintiff's Exhibit 7A. And in each instance, we see a substantial concentration of blacks who, under normal practices in this country, would be able to affect the results of election and the determination of who would be their representative. But when you merge these districts together with the other factors that the court looked at, their votes are substantially diluted. So in Durham County, where we had a black...
And what was the election success experience in those three counties, in those three districts, 39, 21, and 23?
In 1975, a black was elected in House District 39. But between that period and 1982, there were some blacks appointed, but two blacks were elected in 1982, which the Solicitor General and the state used as a basis for saying there could possibly be no dilution because in their position, blacks were elected in proportions higher than their representation in the community.
So, and if there were single-member districts doing the best as you could for the blacks in 39, you probably couldn't have more than two.
You would have two districts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chambers. Yes.
With safe majorities.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chambers, I understood the Solicitor General to say that if these districts were broken up, that blacks would have less opportunity to be elected. I suppose that might depend on the way they were broken up, but what is your response to that?
Your Honor, that is what I was just referring to. That is not the position that I think, that is not accurate. In House District 39,
yes.
With the districts broken up, two black, majority black representative districts were established
yes.
by plans presented by the state. In House District 23, one majority black district was established, and the same in House District 21. But the other point, Your Honor, that we should look at is...
Well, you don't want any further breaking up of those districts.
No. We did not advocate any further breaking up of House District 23 or House District 21.
Is this any more than the court
approved? Any more than the court approved.
And Your Honor, has the legislature acted, or do you merely have the court approval?
The legislature developed these plans and presented them.
Right.
And the district court approved the plan presented by the legislature.
Mm-hmm. So they are in effect.
They are in effect now.
Right.
And elections in 1984 were conducted under there. Mm-hmm.
But it's still by a court order.
By court order. Yes. But even in House District 23 and House District 21, blacks were elected only because blacks single-shot votes. And in doing so, they had to forego any opportunity to affect the elections of the other districts, district representatives. So you see a concentration of blacks voting for a black candidate, unable to vote for any other candidate to have any success in electing a representative. Whites don't have to look to blacks for any support in those districts.
And are you talking about each one of these districts?
House District 21 and House District 23.
Under single-member districts, you're certainly not going to have any chance to influence other.
You do not, Your Honor, but you're also able to elect a representative and determine person who is representing you. Also, if you look at the...
How about past experience in 23 and 21?
In terms of...
Until the court adopted this plan, had there ever been a black elected in 23?
A black was elected in 23 in 1973, Your Honor.
And since then, too?
Since then.
Each
election since 73.
In this multi-member district?
In this multi-member district.
There's been one black elected?
One black. Well, two different blacks were elected, but only one black per term.
I understand. Well, but you wouldn't get any more under single-member district?
You would not, but if you look at...
Well, how about 21?
One black was elected to the State House for the first time in 1980.
And since?
Since.
Under the single-member district, there's been a black elected. So how many elections were there? Beginning with 80, and then 82, there was a black elected.
There was a black elected.
And 84 was under the court plan?
Under the court plan.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Under the multi-member district...
And in District 39, as long as we're going over these three, could you recount what's happened there as well?
Yes, a black was elected in 39 in 1975 and 1977, I believe. No black was elected in 1978, although a black who had been appointed ran and was defeated. A black ran in 1980 who also had been appointed and was running for re-election and was defeated. Two blacks were elected in 1982.
Right.
And as the district court found, looking at the substantial racially block voting, the success of candidates in each of these elections was substantially adversely affected by the way whites refused to support any black candidate.
In each district,
Your Honor, more than 81% of the whites on an average, more than 81% of the whites refused to support any black candidate in the primary.
Well, don't you have to pretty well depend on the polarized voting aspect of this case?
John, I think polarized voting here is important.
Well, you certainly weren't excluded from the from participating in the in the registering or voting or in the party processes at all. In the party of your choice, you had just as much influence as anybody else. And it's just when it comes to, and you had candidates, didn't you?
Yeah, recently the structural barriers to registration had been removed. Historically, there had been problems, but as the district court found, recently those barriers had been removed.
Well, what do you depend on in this case for this conclusion of exclusion from access? Mm-hmm. From non-access, what do you depend on except to polarized voting as really important?
The barriers that had been in effect previously continue to affect the ability of blacks to
How does it do that?
Well, first of all, you have the problem with registration. Mm-hmm. Blacks still were underrepresented in registration as compared with whites. Mm-hmm. There was a problem with large multi-member districts that cost, on an average, twice as much as running in a single-member district. And with the problems that blacks had in their economic condition, they weren't able to support a candidate. Blacks were segregated residentially and didn't have access to whites. So the historical practices that existed previously continued to affect the ability of blacks in 23 and 21, as well as 39 and the other districts looked at, to participate equally and certainly in their ability to elect representatives of their choice. So looking at the facts overall, at the totality of circumstances that the district court was directed to review, even with the 1982 election, blacks were substantially affected in their ability to participate and to elect representatives of their choice.
Well, do you defend the definition of polarized voting that the district court expressed?
Well, I was going to turn to that, Your Honor. In polarized voting, the district court proceeded to analyze what happened there in two steps, which is proper. First, it looked to determine whether blacks and whites, in fact, voted differently. And they, in fact, do. Second, it then proceeded to determine, as the Congress had directed it to.
When you say they in fact do, you mean in this particular situation, not generally over the country?
That's correct, Your Honor, in North Carolina. It then looked at the extent to which blacks and whites voted differently. What the Solicitor General and the state have done is they have taken the first step and said that's the court's definition for severe polarized voting. I ask you to just look at the district court's opinion, and you'll see how the state and the Solicitor General have misread that opinion. Because after looking at whether blacks and whites vote differently, the court then looked at basically three other things. Historically, over 81% of whites have refused or failed to vote for a black candidate in the primary election. Historically, on an average, 60-some percent of whites refuse to vote for a black candidate when the black is nominated.
Historically, back in the 18th century, 19th century, or when? Just the last few years, or when?
We looked at elections from 1978 through 1982. Right.
That's the period.
Right. That's the period.
Okay.
Even where a black is nominated by his party, then, whites fail to vote for a black candidate. So in Forsyth County, House District 39, black candidates are nominated by the Democratic Party and yet defeated by whites refusing or failing to vote for a black Democratic candidate.
And is there party registration in North Carolina?
Yes. There is a
Even though there's a majority of what? Of Democrats or not?
There is a majority of Democrats.
And yet you couldn't elect a black Democrat?
In Forsyth County.
Well, you, yes.
Okay. And so the standard that the district court followed in determining whether racially polarized voting existed was consistent with what Congress had directed. The court also looked at another factor.
Mr. Chambers, do you think the court looked at all in determining racial block voting at the intensity of the block voting, to look at factors that might explain the actual interests, difference in interests at stake to determine the intensity of the voting?
Your Honor, that was not considered necessary by the district court, and I think appropriately, because Congress had eliminated the necessity for determining whether intent existed.
And the not intent, intensity. In other words, the reasons that explain the statistical disparity in the voting and factor in to some degree electoral success. Do you think the court has to do that in appraising racial block voting?
Your Honor, here the district court did patiently look at the success of black candidates in 1982 and before, and the way that whites voted, first to come to a determination that there was severe and significant racial block voting, and second to determine whether 1982 was an aberration from what the pattern was. There was a very intense analysis of those facts for the court to arrive at that decision. The court also looked at racial appeals. In 1983, Senator Helms is still presenting racial appeals like the racial appeals we faced in 1890. So looking at North Carolina overall, we do have a factual situation very similar to those this court considered in White versus Register, and I think a much more appealing case than White versus Register, and the other cases which have followed it, because we have substantial racial block voting. We have substantial racial appeals. We have substantial submergence of blacks in each of the districts, District 23, 21, 39, as well as the other. And we have all the factors that make for dilution of black votes.
Mr. Chambers, may I ask you a question that probably had a very simple answer, but it doesn't occur to me at the moment. How do you know what percentage of whites fail to vote for black voters, and what percentage of blacks did not vote for whites as distinguished from voting for blacks?
Your Honor, first there were two statistical analyses.
Based on what?
Looking at the composition of districts. If whites constitute 95% of a district, looking at the census tract, for example, And if a candidate, a white candidate, receives 95% of those votes, statisticians determine that candidate is receiving 95% of the white votes of that district. And if you look at a racially mixed district, and whites constitute a certain percentage of the residents of that district, and white candidates receive a certain percentage of the votes, then there is a statistical determination that whites vote for white candidates in that particular percentage. And the same with respect to blacks in the district.
These are estimates, though, aren't they? You really can't tell.
They are statistics.
Voting is secret, isn't it?
Voting is secret.
In North Carolina?
Fortunately, it's still secret in North Carolina. Yet one can make a determination that whites have supported a candidate in certain percentages and blacks in another percentage.
While I've interrupted you, when were all of the barriers to registration of blacks removed?
Well,
removed officially. I know your argument is that there were lingering effects.
I think officially, Your Honor, the most recent effort was in 1970. There were still problems, as I understand it, of blacks having to pass a literacy test in some districts.
Up to 1970?
Yes, sir.
May I ask another factual question while you're off the track? In the maps that you've called our attention to, for example, House District 23, which has three members, there's also information concerning the residence of the members. And in each map, there are more residences than there are members, and I'm puzzled. There are six people indicated and only three members. And what is the significance of the residence of the members?
Okay, Your Honor, that was in you're looking at House District 39.
Well, I was having to look at 23. But I can
okay, 23. Well, we look at 23. We have presented here all of the residents, the residences of all of the elected officials since 1978.
Well, of all elected officials, not just of the...
No, of the House of Representatives members and the senatorial members.
Since...
78. We're talking about all of the people who were elected.
Oh, I see. So it covers more than one term of office.
More than one term of office. So what we are depicting here is that with multi-member districts, blacks have limited accessibility to the representatives. As you see here, the representatives are all outside the black residential areas. And that's true in House District 36 as well as House District 23.
I was wondering if you were making the point. It just occurs to me that perhaps if you had single-member districts instead of multi-member, maybe you'd have the same number of blacks, but they might be different blacks.
That is possible, Your Honor. What we are talking about, though, is the ability of blacks to relate to their representatives, to ensure that those representatives are accountable for the way that they represent the interests of blacks. Where they live outside the district, they, first of all, are not accessible. And where blacks have to depend on white votes to elect a representative, they aren't necessarily accountable to the black community. We have testimony in the record how these multi-member districts affect the ability of blacks to protect and advance their own interests. And these are factors, again, looking at the totality of the circumstances that the district court looked at very intensely to determine whether vote dilution, in fact, occurred. Also, if you look, the defendants asked the court to not apply Rule 52 in this particular instance. I think that Rule 52 controls the determination here, and I think is extremely important. First, if we look at the fact that we have three native North Carolinians who sat on this case, they knew the facts in North Carolina. Prior to their appointment to the bench, they had actively participated in politics in North Carolina. One had served as a dean of the law school. And then they looked very closely at whether there was a real opportunity for blacks to participate in each district. And we have then a careful, intense analysis by three native North Carolinians of what was taking place in each district, including the 1982 election, affecting the ability of blacks to participate equally and to elect representatives of their choice. Even in House District 23, where a black was elected since 1973, blacks had to make sure that the candidate running was someone who could appeal to white residents because white votes were necessary for the black to be elected. It was not possible for blacks to get a person elected without extreme single-shot voting and a candidate who could appeal at least to a limited number of whites.
District was that?
House District 23.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's true as well in House District 21. So even in the three districts that the Solicitor General has referred to, as well as the state, blacks do not have and have not had an equal opportunity to participate in the electoral process and to elect representatives of their choice.
Well, in single-member districts, you're only going to be able to vote for one candidate.
Your Honor, that is correct, but you still are able to ensure that you can determine the outcome of that candidate.
Yes.
You can ensure that that candidate is accessible and accountable. And that is what Congress was trying to obtain with the amended Section 2, to make sure that blacks have an equal opportunity to participate with whites in the election of
Your single-shot voting could never alone elect a black candidate in these multi-member districts.
Correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Chambers, you argue that the 52A is applicable. Is that because all these findings are to be treated just as questions, findings of fact?
Yes, Your Honor. I would think that
under — not of mixed questions of law and fact.
I don't think so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I would think that under this Court's decision in Anderson versus Bessemer City, Rule 52 governs the factual determination
well,
as well as the ultimate.
They do historical facts, but don't you think that the definition of polarized voting is a legal question?
Your Honor, I think that the Court has already determined
that may be, but
the definition. But even so,
it still is a legal question, isn't it?
Whether polarized, the definition may be a legal question.
Well, and that's one of the things that is attacked here.
I think both the State and the Solicitor General argue about the factual determination, whether there was, in fact, substantial polarized voting, racial polarized voting.
But only first by disagreeing with what they, with the definition they think the district court adopted.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Chambers, do you have anything further, Mr. Attorney General?
Nothing further, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments.